Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. It began with the assassination of an archduke in Sarajevo 100 years ago and resulted in 4.5 years of death and destruction for millions around the globe. But 100 years later, the legacy of World War I, also known as the Great War, extends far beyond the well-documented carnage. The war also brought about the death of empires, the birth of new nations, and a fundamental reshuffling of the international order in ways that set the stage for a second global conflict only a few decades later. The war also bore witness to major developments in the technology of warfare. With game-changing advances in battlefield armaments, air and sea power, industrial production, and medicine. Even today, 100 years removed from the outbreak of hostilities, historians look to World War I for lessons that may be applicable to the terrorism, political instability, and armed conflict currently flaring up around the globe. Today on The Exchange, we're reconsidering World War I a century later. So let's hear from you. What do you think is the historical legacy of the war 100 years removed? Does your own family history include any interesting connections to the war? Do you see any important parallels with our current period of global unrest? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two guests joining me for the hour this morning. With me in studio is Craig Larkin. Craig is an assistant professor of history at Colby Sawyer College. He teaches European and American history and culture with a special focus on Germany. And Craig, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
And joining me this morning from Hanover, New Hampshire is Richard Ned LeBeau, James O. Friedman Presidential Professor Emeritus at Dartmouth College. Professor LeBeau is the author of the new book, Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives, A World Without World War I. And Ned, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, I'd like to start by talking about the causes of the war. We should note that today, July 28th, is the 100th anniversary of the Austro-Hungarian declaration of war against Serbia, following up on the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by a Serbian national on June 28th, 1914. So those are kind of the basic facts that people often know, but there's an important backstory to be told here, and I'd like to kind of flesh that out a little bit for our listeners. So, Craig, let me start with you a little bit, if you could, about some of the conditions that led up to the war.
Well, there are a number of things that fed into this. I mean, this was not an incident that sort of created or came out of nothing. This was decades, if not centuries, in the making. One of the long-term causes or origins was, of course, the creation of alliance systems in the latter third of the 19th century, which was mostly spearheaded by the efforts of the German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, who was essentially trying to stabilize European politics for purposes of maintaining Germany's relatively recent supremacy in international affairs following the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. They were seeking to isolate France. They were seeking to basically, Bismarck was seeking to create a situation where Germany would be a chief rival to England and perhaps one day even overcome England as the dominant power in world affairs. This alliance system, which basically breaks Europe down into two camps, the Entente powers and the Central powers, Britain, France, Russia versus Germany and Austria-Hungary, is also going to collide with what many historians consider sort of the root cause of the First World War, which is, of course, nationalism. And it was the June 28th assassination of Franz Ferdinand and his wife by Gavrilo Princip and the Black Hand is essentially an expression of Serbian nationalism. And that's going to sort of lead into this massive conflagration that erupts over the next 4.5 years following.
So there is this sort of overlay of kind of ethnic sectarianism and conflict underneath the kind of imperialism and nationalism that you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a multitude of factors coming together sort of in the same fulcrum, the same moment. And you're looking at a scenario where the Serbians are trying to create in 1914 a situation where they're going to sort of displace the declining Ottoman Empire in the Balkans and southeastern Europe and prevent Austria-Hungary from becoming a dominant force politically in that region. And so you're sort of seeing Serbian nationalism, the creation or the pursuit of a greater Serbia, start to take hold. And this is going to come into direct conflict with sort of the legacies, the remnants of this alliance system.
Ned, your thoughts on sort of general causes?
Well, what Craig says is absolutely correct, that you have alliance systems which divide Europe, and you have nationalism which is threatening to all of the great powers. I would add that we need to be very careful in avoiding the conclusion that this made war inevitable. For many decades, historians advanced this argument, largely succumbing to the arguments in the memoirs of policymakers, all of whom had a strong vested interest to argue that the war was inevitable in order to reduce their own personal responsibility for bringing it about. Today, we've increasingly come to see it as a contingent event. So if we look just for a moment at the case of Austria-Hungary, between 1911 and 1914, on four occasions, the Austrians considered going to war with Serbia. They only did so in the aftermath of Sarajevo. And that was because, among other things, Sarajevo removed the presence of Franz Ferdinand, next in line for the throne, who was the strongest advocate for peace in Austria-Hungary, who deeply believed, and history revealed him to be correct, that a war with Russia would threaten the survival of both empires. It made the emperor, normally a peaceful man, more likely to accept war because this was not the first assassination in his family. It made Kaiser Wilhelm, the head of Imperial Germany, a man full of bluster but otherwise lacking in courage. It led him to frame the Austrian-Serbian conflict as a duel and his role as that of a second to Emperor Franz Joseph. So it put Germany on a course to support an Austrian ultimatum and war with Austria. And finally, the German Chancellor, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, recognized that the only way Germany could wage a successful war would be with the support of the large socialist party within Germany. If Russia came to the support of Serbia, and it appeared that Germany was waging a defensive war, he reasoned, he could bring the socialists into support for a war which involved a German invasion of France, which in fact happened. So Sarajevo was more than just the proverbial spark that set alight the dry kindling of Europe. It was more like, if I can use an historical anachronism, a permissive action link on a nuclear weapon. This is the safeguard to prevent it from going off in an unauthorized way. And that safeguard is more complex than the weapon itself.
Now,
it's hard.
Go ahead.
Just to finish for one more second here. It's hard to imagine another incident that would have met these conditions that made Austria and Germany willing to consider risking war. And it's even more difficult to consider any other European powers who would have initiated actions that might have led to war.
Now, Craig, both you and Ned have described this power dynamic revolving around nationalism, imperialism, and ethnic conflict. Is there an underlying economic dimension to this you can talk about? We often think about wars stemming from economic preconditions as well. So maybe you could talk about that.
Well, certainly. One of the things that needs to be addressed when looking at sort of why the war breaks out when it does in 1914, and I agree with Ned completely that this was not an inevitable conflict, is that each of the major powers that we focus on had serious domestic issues to the point that for many of these leaders, war becomes sort of a distraction from some of the internal or domestic problems. When you're talking about economics, I mean, you could look at some of the struggles that Germany itself was beginning to experience in the early 19-teens as their economy began to falter. You could look at some of the lingering effects of the lengthy crisis of the so-called Irish question that England was facing. France, by the early part of the 19-teens, was a deeply, deeply divided and scarred country. One of my favorite statistics to share with students is that in 1913, France suffered over 2.2 million workdays lost due to strikes. There was immense labor unrest. 1 year into the war, they only lost about 50,000 days, work days, to strike. So there's a lot of underlying frustration, discontent. And so the war for leaders becomes sort of a way of guiding some of that anger, guiding some of that emotion toward this idea of a national cause or a national celebration, as it were. And so you've got this sort of intermingling of ongoing economic domestic problems with these larger scale issues related to nationalism, imperialism, and ethnic conflict. Absolutely.
Ned, your thoughts on the economic dimension?
Yes. I think that both economics and domestic politics push just as strongly in the opposite direction. So let's work our way from west to east. In the case of Britain, they were consumed with the Irish question because of the possible civil war in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants. That made the British even more concerned for peace, not for war. In the case of Germany, in the months and weeks and even days before the war, the Kaiser consulted with many of the leading industrial and shipping magnates in that country. Every single one of them urged peace on the Kaiser. They said, Europe is falling into our hands due to trade and investment. We can only benefit by peace. Even Krupp, who was head of the largest armaments outfit in Germany, was a spokesman for peace in this regard. France, Ferdinand, had prepared extensive notes about what he would do when he became emperor, which would have been in 1916, which we now know is when Franz Josef died. His major concern was dealing with domestic unrest within the empire caused by nationalism. To do so, he was going to create a triadic rather than the dyadic state that currently existed with the Hungarians and the Austrians being the dominant group. He was going to bring in as well the South Slavs.
Ned,
for these reasons, he wanted peace.
Yeah, let me hold you right there. We'll continue. We have to take a short break, but we'll talk a lot more about the far-reaching impacts of World War I. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Four prizes left to give away in only 6 days for you to get in on NHPR's Summer Car Raffle. Don't miss out on your chance to win a kayak, a bike, a grill, or $25,000 towards a brand new car and help support NHPR at the same time. Go to NHPR.org to buy your raffle tickets or give us a call at 1-888-805-NHPR. Showers and thunderstorms for today. Some thunderstorms may have gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Muggy highs today, mid to upper 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Upton and Hatfield, continuing a long tradition of serving the legal needs of people and communities of New Hampshire. Information at UptonHatfield.com. And Landmark College in Putney, Vermont, offering a professional certificate in universal design with technology integration, online and blended courses, online at landmark.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about the history lessons of the First World War. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. My guests today are in studio with me is Craig Larkin. He's assistant professor of history at Colby Sawyer College. He teaches European and American history and culture with a special focus on Germany. And joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Richard Ned LeBeau, the James O. Friedman Presidential Professor Emeritus at Dartmouth College. He's the author of the new book, Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives, A World Without World War I. And gentlemen, I want to continue to talk about and sort of shift from the causes into talking a little bit about the war itself. But first, I want to go to the phones. And we have Chris joining us from Kittery, Maine. Chris, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning, panel.
Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. My story is anecdotal. My grandfather, I'm from Glasgow, Scotland. My grandfather joined up, lied about his age. When he was 17, as a lot of young guys did, and even into battle with a Gaelic Southern Highlander regiment, and even into battle in full Highland dress, He ended up losing half a lung in a mustard gas attack, was invalided out, but he was still alive. But even when he went into battle in a full Highland dress, the Germans saw him coming through the mist, the smoke, and a lot of them had, most of them had never seen a Highlandman before, so they thought there were women coming against them until they got in among them with the cold steel. And then and the Germans ended up giving them the nickname, the Ladies from Hell, which they still wear in their regimental banners to this day.
That's a great story, Chris. And let me ask you, Craig, as we shift to talking about the war itself, tremendous human cost to this war, troops coming from all over Europe. Say a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things to keep in mind is that everyone anticipated this would be a three-month, four-month-long war that wound up going 4.5 years, cost tens of millions of lives, both in terms of soldiers and civilians, some through combat and the development of new technologies, including, as Chris just pointed out, sort of the development of chemical weapons and their widespread use, both in terms of mustard gas, chlorine gas, what have you. But also through methods including sort of the British naval blockade against Germany, which is going to result in massive food shortages. And you mentioned that this is sort of a mess of human event with millions coming from around Europe. But this was truly also a global war. You also have millions coming from various colonies and dominions to represent Britain, France, and to a lesser extent some of the central powers in Europe as well. And they are going to get caught up in these events as well, and oftentimes not fully understanding why. But when you're looking at the human cost, just think about some of the individual or noteworthy battles, the Battle of Verdun, the Battle of the Somme, both in 1916, where you're looking at combined casualties over 1 million for both battles. The Battle of the Somme, the very first day of the attack, the British are going to suffer anywhere from 50,000 to 60,000 casualties. They fire off nearly 2 million shells in the first 7 to 10 days of the attack, the assault. Unfortunately, about a third of them are duds. So this is going to sort of create the conditions for this massive and unprecedented loss of life.
And Chris, thank you for the call. We appreciate you calling in. Ned, let me have you pick up there. You know, we know the first couple of years of World War One, Germans, British, French, all involved, and then the United States jumps in partway through the war. Say a little bit about the conditions for the U.S. getting into the war.
Well, certainly. So the United States remained neutral, and Woodrow Wilson, president at the time, aspired to play a role of a mediator to bring together the two sides to end the war. This didn't work out because each side was unprepared to compromise on the basis of the status quo antebellum, and neither side was willing to let the other get away with making any territorial gains. The Germans increasingly resorted to submarine warfare against shipping. Now, here there was escalation because initially U-boats would surface, would tell merchantmen to get into lifeboats, anybody aboard the boat, the ship, because they were going to sink it. The British then began arming merchant ships to attack submarines that surfaced. So the Germans began sinking these British merchant ships without notification. The British then began to put neutral flags on their ships, including American ones. Up to that point, the Germans had been avoiding going after neutral shipping. Now, neutral shipping began to be hit. A famous incident was, of course, the Lusitania, when a big passenger ship that had Americans on it sunk off the coast of Ireland, and the Germans had, in fact, accurate information that war materials were put aboard, which was against international law for passenger ships. But the decisive event took place in January 1917, when the Germans decided to launch unrestricted submarine warfare. That is, they would sink anything they could find anywhere that was heading toward an Allied port. They did this knowing that Britain only grows enough food to feed itself 6 weeks of the year. They hope that by cutting off food, fuel, and munitions, they could bring Britain to their knees. They recognize that this would bring the United States into the war, but gambled that they could beat Britain before American entry would have much effect. They also greatly underestimated the number of forces that the Americans could bring to France. So they declared warfare in March of 1917, and the following month, Woodrow Wilson got the Congress to agree to American entry in the war.
And, Ned, we're going to talk about technology in a moment. You mentioned the issue of submarine warfare. But let's go back to the phones first. And we have Richard joining us from Hopkinton. Richard, welcome to the exchange.
Hello. This is Richard. And I'm a German-American. And I'm aware of the fact that there was rampant German anti-German hysteria, to include lynchings after 1917. I wonder what the German-American position was, a significant portion of the population of the United States, what the German-American position was with respect to the war. Thank you.
Richard, thank you for that call. Craig, let me turn to you a little bit about the German-American experience during the war.
Well, it's a great question because German-Americans were the largest immigrant or ethnic community within the United States during the First World War, and that was a fairly significant issue to take into consideration for President Wilson. Once the U.S. position started to lean more and more toward the British and French, and once the U.S. entered the war, being a German-American became sort of a stigma, became grounds for suspicion. And German-Americans found themselves, civilians, business leaders, found themselves being followed by the FBI and local police. There were sporadic outbreaks of violence against German-Americans, as Richard indicated. And we, perhaps most famously, saw sort of an attempt to cleanse or wash American culture of sort of German marks or indicators. So, you know, Frankfurters or sauerkraut are going to be renamed to take away the Germanness of those goods. And the extent, the degree of vitriol or suspicion of German-Americans is going to go so far as to sort of play a leading role in creating the possibility for something like prohibition. I mean, when you think about the beer industry in America, it was dominated by German-Americans. The beer trade groups had their meetings minutes in German. This became grounds for some of the prohibitionists and teetotalers to basically say these are un-American people. They're using our supplies against our soldiers to weaken us in the war effort against the Kaiser.
Fascinating cultural implications for the U.S. For our listeners, we're talking about the 100th anniversary of the onset of World War I. You can join us here at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange at nhpr.org. And my guests in studio, I have Craig Larkin. He's an assistant professor of history at Colby Sawyer College. And joining us on the line from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Richard Ned LeBeau, the James O. Friedman Presidential Professor Emeritus at Dartmouth College. And Ned, let me go back to you. You mentioned submarine warfare. And one of the interesting things about World War I are the advances in technology, the kind of the technology of warfare, not just submarines, but machine guns, poison gas, et cetera. Can you say a little bit about that sort of the technological angle here?
Yes. Well, World War I involved governments in trying to improve weaponry of all kinds. So the most important consequence of this, which goes far beyond any particular weapons that were developed, and we have a number of those, the tank, the effective diesel submarine, improvements in aircraft. The really important thing was close involvement between government and industry, and with it, a government coordination of industry. And this was particularly novel in Britain and the United States, countries that hitherto had believed in laissez-faire capitalism. This paved the way for government intervention during the Great Depression, which had a major impact, for government involvement in World War II and the Cold War, and funding of basic research with billions and billions and billions of dollars. So it would have a payoff that extended far beyond World War I, and would result in such things ultimately as the development and use of antibiotics, the information revolution. All of this are delayed products of a cooperation and funding that began in World War I. The other thing that's important here and generally undersung is think about one of the great medical advances of the war, which was blood transfusions. Now, ever since the time of Harvey, several hundred years before, blood transfusions had been tried. They generally failed because nobody knew at that point that you had to give the right kind of blood depending on the blood type of the recipient. It had to match with that of the donor. By 1914, they knew that, but to make this work, you needed to know the blood types of donors and possible recipients. This required record-taking. Administration was created to enable this kind of information to be collected, stored, and made readily available. It provided the basis for almost every kind of effective medical intervention that's happened since.
Craig, I want to hear your thoughts on technology as well, but let's go back to the phones again. And we have Mike joining us from Derry. Mike, welcome to the exchange.
How's it going? Professor Larkin, I remember me. I was a student of yours. I'm Coley Sawyer. But my comment is that I feel World War I was a similar to the American Civil War in that technology had outpaced tactics. In the Civil War, we had much more advanced and accurate weaponry, but the generals were still lining their soldiers up in formations from the Napoleonic era. And the same thing happened in World War One. We now had machine guns and far more accurate artillery and airplanes, but the generals were still sending their troops from over the top and just rushing these emplacements. And that's my comment. Professor Larkin, how's it going? And I'll take my comments. I'll take your answers off the air.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Craig, great question. I've read that, you know, the machine guns made it really easy to defend the trenches, but very hard to overtake and the sort of the end of the cavalry as we knew it in the Civil War. Say a little bit about weaponry.
Absolutely. And hello, Mike. Yes, I do remember you. I mean, there's the old adage that you fight or prepare for the last war. And if you sort of look at the Civil War, the First World War, and the Second World War as a triumvirate, you sort of see this as Mike correctly pointed out, this shift where technology is advancing so much more than some of the military leaders anticipate or understood. And so the tactics that they use, at least with 2020 hindsight, look out of date, look misplaced. And so with the First World War, with the machine gun, you're talking about something where there's sort of a relative newness to it. It had developed toward the end of the 19th century. But what many of the military leaders, especially in the Western Front, anticipated in the first years of the war was that this was going to be a war that would be won with massive offensive assaults against the enemy. But the technology had actually benefited defensive maneuvers, defensive alignments, particularly the machine gun. And if I can, I mean, one of my favorite movie scenes of all time in sort of the war genre is, of course, the 1930 rendition of All Quiet on the Western Front, where the camera takes sort of the position of the machine gun, and you see these soldiers who are crossing no man's land essentially being mowed down as if they were sitting ducks. They did not stand a chance. And it's a great example, a great illustration of how technology had basically altered the very nature of warfare, but had done so at such a pace that it was very hard to comprehend in that moment.
Could I piggyback to this one?
Absolutely. Let me frame it as, you know, I'd like to start to shift our focus up towards sort of the aftermath and World War II. But yeah, say a little bit about kind of the technological continuity there in the first half of the century.
There's a very important reason why generals on all sides were utterly obtuse to the lessons not only of the American Civil War, but the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 5, which illustrated the power of trenches, barbed wire, and machine guns. And that has to do with class. The cavalry was the high social status arm of the military. It was staffed entirely by blue-blooded aristocrats. Machine guns, trench digging, all of this stuff was seen as something that could be left to common people and reserve officers to command. So there was a vested interest in maintaining belief in the efficacy of the offensive in order to maintain class standards. And for the Germans, this, of course, was also tied up with one of the reasons the war was being fought. This only changed when cavalry was destroyed and much of the German aristocracy was mowed down in the First Battle of the Marne.
Craig, a little bit about air power. We haven't talked too much about that. Was this a significant factor in the war?
It is a factor. I don't know if I would go so far as to say sort of a significant.
They're still using Zeppelins at this point?
You got to remember that this is such a relatively new technology, right? The Wright brothers just had their, 15-second flight about 12 years or 11 years before the war began. There had been earlier experiments with some air power or air combat, the Turco-Italian War in 1911, for example, being one of the earliest examples that I know of off the top of my head. You do get some sort of romanticized stories, the Red Baron, for example, that sort of illustrate that there's potential here. And you have some people even before the war sort of pointing to the skies as future sites of armament and weaponry. H.G. Wells is the War in the Air being an example. But I think if you ask most generals or soldiers at the time, they probably anticipated the war would be fought or decided on the battleground or at the sea at best. It was a new technology, but it would be in the Second World War or the Spanish Civil War, even before that, where you would start to see it become much, much more important to military strategy.
Is there any one sort of technical innovation above all the others that you would say was pivotal in the First War?
In the First World War, pivotal, I would say, just because of the psychological impact it had, would be the use of chemical weapons. You also see things like tanks, for example, being developed and used during the First World War.
A little bit about that. Tanks were fairly new at that time?
Very new and not terribly effective. There's sort of a steep learning curve during the First World War in how to best utilize this new technology. But much like with air power, it would be much more effective, much more important come the Second World War between the late 1939 and 45.
We do have to take one more short break. After the break, we'll continue talking about the legacy of World War I. We'll talk a little bit about the current situation around the globe and see if there are any parallels to be drawn here. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHBR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
NHPR Summer Car Raffle may be on its way out, but there's plenty of time left in the season to enjoy the prizes. The Vermont Castings Grill from Eastern Oil and Propane, the Trek Bike with accompanying roof rack from S&W Sports, and the Kayak from Portsmouth Kayak Adventures. Each offer great opportunities to while away the remaining hours of daylight. Get your $50 tickets at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-NHPR. And good luck.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, a sustainable system improving the health of our communities for generations to come. Imagine.d-h.org. And UNH Continuing Education announcing fall registration is now ongoing, with classes beginning September 2nd. More information online at learn.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about the trend of going gluten-free. But today we're talking about the 100-year anniversary of World War I. You can join us with your thoughts by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can find us on Twitter or Facebook in order to continue the conversation there. And I have two guests with me today in studio. I have Craig Larkin, Assistant Professor of History at Colby Sawyer College. And joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Richard Ned LeBeau, the James O. Friedman Presidential Professor Emeritus at Dartmouth College and author of the new book, Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives, A World Without World War I. And gentlemen, I want to shift the discussion up to the present time. We can talk a little bit about World War II, but sort of the legacy and current lessons as well. So let's go to the phones. And joining us from Nottingham is Steve. Steve, thanks for hanging in there. Welcome to The Exchange.
This is a very important topic, and I want to go two ways simultaneously. First, I want to go back to the war itself. One of the forgotten parts of it was the flu of 1917. That actually killed more people than all the combat combined and led to a lot of things called public health. The second is the legacy of the dividing of the Middle East. The famous cutting up of the Middle East by France and England via Lawrence of Arabia, the Balfour Declaration, all these things are as current today, unfortunately, as the news that we'll hear at the hour.
Steve, thanks for your call. Ned, let me turn to you on that, the flu and also the current situation in the Middle East.
Well, this is one of the reasons why historians generally agree that World War I was the dominant event of the 20th century, because so much that happened afterwards, not only in politics, but in culture, in medicine, in movements of people around the world, was very much a consequence of this conflict. Now, the pandemic flu, which began in India, was not a direct consequence of the war. It came to Europe just at the end of the war and indeed killed more people than were killed by bombs and bullets during the war itself. One could possibly argue that the deprivation in calories made people more receptive to the flu, although it's also true that the flu tended to kill healthy young men much more than it killed debilitated elder people. But it certainly was a catastrophe of world proportions, not just European proportions. With respect to the Middle East, ironically, just as empires were falling apart, Russia and the Ottoman Empire and Austria-Hungary being the three cases in point, the British and French thought that it had an extended shelf life. Between them, they divided up the Middle East and created these new countries of Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, countries that were carved out of land that was once part of the Ottoman Empire, and the Palestine Mandate, which later, of course, would become Israel and Jordan. The conflicts that exist in the Middle East are attributable both to nationalism and struggles over raw materials. Those were present, but they were certainly exacerbated by the collapse of the Ottomans and the imposition of colonial rule. In this regard, the Ottomans had a more sophisticated policy in dealing with ethnic groups. They allowed each of them a very high degree of internal self-governance to reduce the conflicts between them, but they had to pay taxes to the Ottomans above.
Greg, let me hear from you as well on the Middle East, but I'm interested if you can make kind of a bridge between World War I and the present, maybe talk a little bit about the aftermath, kind of World War II and the post-war period.
Right. Well, when looking at the Middle East and its relationship to the First World War, I think what we're really talking about is sort of the negotiations that take place during the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. And prior to that, several agreements, particularly among the British and the French, as to what to do once the Ottoman Empire, sort of this the sick man of Europe, was taken out of commission. And during the war itself, the British and the French, through the Sykes-Picot Agreement, had basically agreed to a partitioning of the Middle East with what is now Syria, Lebanon essentially going to France, what is essentially Palestine, and what would be created in Iraq going to England. But during the Paris Peace Conference itself, the British Premier David Lloyd George sort of starts to regret that agreement and starts to make sort of efforts to sort of get more and more land. Particularly to sort of shore up interest in and around the Suez Canal region in the Middle East, because it's such a vital water route with connecting England and its colony in India. What we wind up seeing is that sort of the ham-handed nature of the negotiations there are going to create numerous resentments, not only between England and France itself and sort of reinvigorating an old rivalry, but among local interests in and around the Middle East itself, many whom had been made promises if they had helped the English against the Ottomans during the war that they would be granted some level of autonomy, if not outright independence. And so we start to sort of see the idea of Arab nationalism really begin to take hold in the interwar era And that is going to be exacerbated by some of the issues that stem from the Second World War and the creation of the State of Israel after the Second World War. And I think that's sort of a big bridge between what happens from 1914 to 1919 and the modern day. And a lot of the resentments that we saw take place in 1919, 1920 are still very much present today.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We have Jay joining us from Canterbury. Jay, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, I was wondering if your guests could talk about the acetone and the Balfour Agreement.
Ned, do you want to take that?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. There is a misconception that the Balfour Declaration, which I should explain to viewers that don't know, which was made in 1917 by British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour, but with the support of President Wilson, promised to create a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. And it became the basis for the British Mandate and ultimately for the State of Israel. There is a misconception that somehow this was a gift to Chaim Weizmann, a Russian Jewish chemist who became a British citizen and developed ways of vastly improving the explosive production in Britain to provide munitions for shells. In fact, the British did this for largely strategic reasons and hoped to use Weizmann and the Jews to solidify their position in the Middle East, the same way the Jews and Weizmann hoped that British backing would strengthen the yeshiv, the Jewish settlement in Palestine. So that does create the basis for what became Israel, and as Craig has pointed out, the British simultaneously made various promises to Arab leaders as well. So the double dealing only increases nationalist tensions, which would have been acute in any case.
Jay, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and we have John joining us from Nashua. John, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. It's... I have a question for your gentleman there. I'd like to get their opinion on the personalities of the Kaiser and Moltke, von Moltke, the who was the military the head of the general staff at the start of the war, and how their interplay actually brought the war into started the war off.
Great. Could I take a crack at that?
Yes, and then we'll also hear from Craig as well, but please go ahead.
Sure.
Thanks, John.
So, von Moltke hated France and desperately wanted war. And he wanted war also because he believed that Germany was becoming soft, that the younger generation was more interested in making money and having a happy life than in serving their country and, surprisingly, than dying on the battlefield. From 1905 on, in the first Moroccan crisis, every time a crisis arose, Moltke demanded a war. Now, what Moltke did was to jigger the German war plans and to create a plan which has been called the Schlieffen Plan, but was really the Moltke Plan, that only left Germany with one possible option in the case of war, which was an invasion of France, even if it was only a war against Russia. Germany was required to invade France, denude the Eastern Front of troops, beat France, and then rush troops to the east to deal with the Germans before they got to Berlin. Now, Moltke himself knew that this was a very hazardous and risky war plan. He also knew from running war games that the defense in the West was a far more successful strategy, and that every type of exercise he ran to make the defense lose wouldn't work. It won every time. So he kept this information secret from the Kaiser, and in 1914 told him that it's now or never, because by 1917 Germany had no longer any chance of successfully invading France before the Russians, with improved railway networks, marched into Berlin. So he put pressure on the Kaiser. He deliberately distorted the facts of the case in the hope that he could produce a war. The Kaiser, as we know, was an insecure man with a physical disability who was full of bluster, but not very courageous, readily manipulated by others, but also somebody out of control. Rather than exercising any kind of judgment in 1914, he let himself be manipulated by others and at the height of the crisis had what psychiatrists call a dissociative reaction, a nervous breakdown. He sat in a dark corner in Potsdam, incommunicado for 24 hours while all the critical decisions were made.
Craig, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to deal with something I've heard in the news recently. I've heard a lot of commentators draw parallels with World War One, the conditions surrounding World War One, and current situation, and whether it's Israel and Gaza, or the Ukraine, or Libya, or Syria. You know, Russian nationalism, Putin. Pick your hot spot. And a lot of people saying there are similarities. Do you agree with that?
To a certain extent. I mean, I would caution against making direct connections between what is going on in 1914 and 2014.
Sure.
But if you look at some of the situations or some of the regions where these issues are arising, and I would throw in there some of the contentiousness in East Asia, for example, you can sort of see some parallels. Some of the ingredients are shared between 2014. There is a great essay by Richard Evans out in the New Republic earlier this year that was sort of making this very same argument that there are certain things we can learn from 1914 about the present day. And he was writing before the recent flare-up in Israel and Gaza. He was writing well before the Ukrainian issue became sort of headline news in the last couple of weeks again. But what he was basically pointing out was if you have a scenario where you have large, powerful states that are, for one reason or another, insecure and are in gambling with sort of bluster, then you have the danger of creating another spark. Well before the Ukrainian issue became a civil war, when only the protests were developing in late 2013, a number of commentators were pointing out that one of the worst-case scenarios is that if the Ukraine sort of dissolves and there is a conflict, it could pull Russia in, it could pull the European Union in, it could pull the United States in and create a much larger conflict. That said, I would like to think that one of the lessons that we can draw from the First World War is the potential ramifications of those kinds of decisions from policymakers.
And Ned, we have about 2 minutes left, but I know you have some thoughts on this question as well.
I do. In fact, later this summer, together with the historian Chris Clark, from my Cambridge colleague, we're running a workshop for European foreign ministers on the lessons of World War One. One of the lessons is to avoid the kinds of superficial analogies that Richard Evans tends to make. People often make connections on the basis of superficial rather than underlying similarities between events and draw the wrong lessons from it. 1914 took place in a very specific political context that shaped how leaders responded. 2014, whether we're talking about conflicts over offshore oil in the Far East or conflicts in the Ukraine, takes place in a very different context, in which leaders have different goals and leaders are also aware of many of the things that happened in the past. We also lack alliance systems that lead to chain reactions if one side takes an action. So these major differences make almost all analogies to 1914 seriously misleading.
And Craig, we just have a moment here, but I want to note that we received an email from the Colby Sawyer history team. They said they're listening enthusiastically, and they wanted to know about the Zimmerman telegram and how important that was. If you could say that in a minute or so.
Well, the Zimmerman telegram is obviously or naturally sort of the attempt or alleged attempt by Germany to sort of get Mexico to invade the United States before the United States could formally enter the war in 1917. And it sort of points to one of the underlying issues that sort of shaped the American war experience during the First World War, which is America had its own set of problems or foreign policy issues that it had to address at that time. And one of the biggest was, of course, Mexico, which had the United States had been involved in sort of on-again, off-again conflicts or skirmishes with Mexico along the border ever since the Mexican Revolution. And is a factor, but not necessarily the sort of the decisive factor in sort of pushing the United States into the war. It was sort of a nice little shove, though.
Well, they wanted to know whether the telegram made a big difference in terms of the timing of getting into the war, and you're saying...
I attribute it more to sort of Wilson's desire to get into the conflict, despite his 1916 promise not to enter the war, and his desire to sort of go to war against Germany. I mean, he was leaning heavily, despite America's neutrality, leaning heavily toward siding with the British and the French against German interests.
Well, we're glad to hear that the Colby Story History team is listening in. We hope you've enjoyed listening to your professor. They say they'll see you in the fall. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I think this is a topic that will continue to be a rich one for exploration and reconsideration. I think people are going to continue to look for historical lessons to emerge. I'd like to thank my guests for joining us this morning. Craig, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Craig Larkin. He's an assistant professor of history at Colby Sawyer College. And Ned LeBeau, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you very much, Dean.
That's Richard Ned LeBeau, James O. Friedman Presidential Professor Emeritus at Dartmouth College and author of the new book, Archduke Franz Ferdinand Lives, A World Without World War I. It's an interesting book. It is a counterfactual consideration of what would have happened had Franz Ferdinand not been assassinated. That's Ned's new book. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our interns are James Pulliot and Renee Taylor. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And we're going to leave you today with an iconic piece of music from the World War I era. It's George M. Cohen's Over There.
Show your grit, do your bit. Yankee to the ranks from the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you and the old red, white, and blue.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
NHPR Summer Car Raffle may be on its way out, but there's plenty of time left in the season to enjoy the prizes. The Vermont Castings Grill from Eastern Oil and Propane, the Trek Bike with accompanying roof rack from S&W Sports, and the Kayak from Portsmouth Kayak Adventures. Each offer great opportunities to while away the remaining hours of daylight. Get your $50 tickets at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-NHPR. And good luck.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from your listeners and from Seacoast Physiatry, independent rehabilitation physicians, specializing in the diagnosis and treatment of muscle, joint, nerve, and tendon problems since 1989. SeacoastPhysiatry.com. And Ford and McPartland, PA, representing businesses, trustees, and institutional creditors in bankruptcy and troubled debt matters. Ford and McPartland, PA.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVU Concord.
89.1. WEVS Nashua.
88.3. WEVH Hanover.
91.3. WEVN Keene.
90.7. WEVC Gorham.
107.1. WEVJ Jackson.
99.5. WEVF Colebrook.
90.3. WEVQ Littleton.
91.9. And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. At a White House meeting Friday, President Obama told the presidents of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala that many of the children from their countries who have turned themselves into U.S. border agents will need to be sent home. Since last October, about 57,000 children from Central America have arrived in the U.S. illegally. But Congress seems deadlocked on ways to address the child migration crisis and on the larger issue of what to do about the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country. Now President Obama has vowed to do as much as he can on his own to fix our immigration system. Next steps on immigration. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The UN Security Council has demanded an immediate, unconditional ceasefire in Gaza. Both Israel and the Palestinians have criticized the demand. Israel says it makes no mention of Palestinian militants who fire rockets into Israel. Palestinians say it does not insist that Israel stop its aggression in the Palestinian territory. As diplomatic efforts for a formal deal continue, there's been a lull after 20 days of fighting. As Linda Gradstein reports, Israel says its policy is to return fire only when fired upon.
Both rocket fire from Gaza into Israel and Israeli air and artillery strikes into Gaza have declined significantly as Palestinians in Gaza mark the first day of the four-day holiday at the end of the Ramadan holy month of fasting. Israeli military officials said they're implementing a new policy of firing only when they are fired on, such as when they responded to a rocket fired at Ashkelon today. Palestinian hospital officials said a four-year-old Palestinian was killed by Israeli artillery. Israeli officials said that an estimated 50% of Hamas's store of rockets has been destroyed in the past 3 weeks of fighting. For NPR News, I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Argentina could default on billions of dollars in debt this week. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports the country has